They are simply outputs of your consciousness. Your consciousness is the part of your brain that spends all day processing your thoughts and feelings and the information your senses pick up. When you start paying attention to your inner voice, you'll notice that it follows certain patterns. Sometimes it makes you worried, upset, or surprised. It also influences your emotions. Sometimes we get so caught up in our own thoughts that we forget they are actually just objects of our consciousness. This is the difference between our self and our personal self. Your self is your pure consciousness, which flows as it likes. Your personal self is the way you perceive yourself and the patterns of your thoughts. If you often feel sad, for example, you might start to think of yourself as a sad person. If you are always envious of others, you might see yourself as a jealous person. To become enlightened, you have to accept that these thoughts and feelings do not define you. Your sadness is not you. Your jealousy is not you. The real you is merely aware of the role these thoughts and feelings play. Consciousness is wonderful and mysterious. It is just like the energy we all have inside ourselves. If you can learn to flow with this powerful energy, you can do just about anything. Just like energy of the physical world, there is an internal energy inside you. Imagine that your partner broke up with you. Since then, you have been laying in bed, feeling depressed and lethargic. Then, one day, your ex calls you up, saying they never should have left you and they want to come back to you. You'll probably feel a sudden burst of energy, like you can take the world on. This energy is called qi in Chinese medicine. If you want to feel it, you need to open your mind and let it flow. Inner energy may seem magical or intangible, but it is actually very real. It is a resource that is always there, just waiting for you to tap into it. We do not feel it constantly because we tend to subconsciously block it. We break its natural flow. Picture yourself driving down the road. As you move along, you'll notice buildings, traffic lights, people, and trees. Then, suddenly, you think you see your ex walking down the street, holding hands with someone new. You'll keep driving, but your consciousness will become completely consumed by this one image. You'll return to this over and over and over in your mind. It will make you anxious and jealous, and you won't be able to relax. In situations like this, you've got to let negative thoughts pass through you. Otherwise, your inner energy will build and become blocked. Unreleased energy can lead to negative emotions like depression. Your consciousness has a bad habit of focusing on negative things. Yet, there is a reason we evolved this way. Focusing on our predators made us more likely to survive. Unfortunately, this trait has pushed us to be very sensitive to fear and anxiety. So how can you put your fear and anxiety aside to live a more carefree and enjoyable life? Fear is also an object of your consciousness. You can deal with it in two ways. Recognize its presence and let it go, or run away from it. It is very hard to accept that fear is just an object of your consciousness. This is why we often just bottle it up. We even structure our lives so nothing ever triggers fear to protect ourselves from it. Think about any time you have had a splinter in your finger. If you touch it, it hurts. You may find it difficult to sleep at night because you accidentally bump your finger or rub against it the wrong way. In this situation, you have two choices. Modify your behavior and movements so nothing ever touches the splinter, or attack the problem and pull it out. Letting go of your fear is just like removing that splinter. Accept that your fear is just a separate thing you need to remove. It is not a part of you. It does not define you. Fear is ultimately the result of blocked inner energy. When your natural flow of energy gets blocked, it cannot reach your heart. Your heart will become weaker and more susceptible to fear. Enlightenment is not about eliminating fear. That would be unrealistic. The goal is to reach a point where you are aware of fear, but you do not let it consume and take over your life. Letting go of your thoughts and feelings is the key to spiritual growth. But what if you could train your consciousness to turn away from yourself, your thoughts, and emotions? What if your consciousness could transcend all that and become something even more profound? Your consciousness is tightly bound up in your personal self. That mental construction shaped over the years by your thoughts and feelings. Your personal self functions like a cage that your consciousness cannot get out of. If you have ever been to a zoo, you might have felt sorry for the animals you saw trapped in small cages. You are trapped in a sort of cage too. You are trapped in your own self. We impose mental boundaries on our own minds to protect ourselves from anything we feel threatens our idea of who we are. When you let go of your thoughts, your consciousness can expand. Have you ever been so immersed in a movie that you forgot all about the world around you? Your consciousness works the same way. It is always so focused on your thoughts that it tunes everything else out. Buddhists call this clinging. As long as you go on clinging, you are building a cage for yourself. When you let go, you'll realize how much freedom there is to gain when your consciousness isn't clinging to the thoughts, impressions, and feelings that flow through it. When you let these thoughts flow on their own, your consciousness expands. Your negative thoughts won't bring you down. They'll simply float on by. This is how you transcend your personal self. Humans are said to be the only creatures who are aware that they will one day die. People have struggled with this concept for all of human history. Sure, death is frightening, but it also gives life meaning. What would you do today if you knew it was your last day? Yogis and saints have always embraced death. In the words of Saint Paul, "O death, where is thy sting? O grave, where is thy victory?" Reflecting on death can actually make your relationships truly meaningful. Perhaps you are a jealous person. You see your wife talking to another man at a party, and this upsets you. But what if you take a moment to reflect on what would happen if you died? Do you really want to be the only person who ever cared for her? When you reflect on death, you'll realize that the most important thing is for your wife to be happy. It is just not worth it to ruin your evening or have a fight because she talked to another man. Reflecting on death also helps you prioritize what is important in your life. Consider all the activities you do during the day and all the time and energy they require. Now, imagine that you know you are going to die in a week. How would you change your life? How would you spend your final days? Now ask yourself, why are you not doing those things now? What is hindering you? What is stopping you? Do not waste your time on unimportant things. If something is so important that you'd want to do it before you die, you should do it now. Why do most people fail at their New Year's resolutions? It is often because they don't find the right balance between what they want and what they can realistically achieve, or at least what they believe they can achieve. Tao Te Ching, one of the world's most profound spiritual teachings, holds that there is a way, or Tao, between extremes, and it leads to the best result. Imagine you are in a relationship, and you want to be with your partner every waking moment. You cling to them and want to do everything together. How long will that relationship last? Now, imagine an opposite situation. You like to be independent, live on your own, and travel alone. You haven't seen your partner in several months, maybe even years. Are you even still in a relationship? In both of these extreme cases, your relationship will probably fall apart. If you want a healthy, long-lasting relationship, you need to find the Tao between them. The same is true for everything in life. When we lose our way from this balanced path, we also lose a lot of energy. Let us say you want to go from point A to point B. If you wander aimlessly, perhaps even getting lost, it will certainly take you much longer to reach your destination, and you'll be very tired when you get there. Instead, you should stay to the path. You will keep much more energy, and this will empower you later on. When you find the right path in life and stick to it, you won't just feel energized, but your life will be simpler and clearer too. Final summary. You are not your thoughts. You are simply aware of your thoughts. Recognize this and let them go. Do not let your consciousness get too hung up on any one thought, or else you're putting yourself in a cage. When you master this and let your inner energy flow, you'll be happier, healthier, and more enlightened. The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. Wherever you go, there you are, by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Wherever you go, there you are, explains how to fully enjoy the present moment without worrying about the past or the future, by providing a step-by-step meditation practice, both formal and informal, that can easily be incorporated into everyday life. Kabat-Zinn steers us toward the peace and tranquility that we are yearning for. How often have you found yourself in a perfect situation? On holiday, say, in a wonderful city, enjoying the sights, or sunbathing on a beautiful beach, or walking through a picturesque forest. Whatever it is exactly where you want to be. But then it hits you. You are not all there. Instead, you're thinking about the laundry that needs to be done, or the incomplete work assignment when you get back. Our minds do this. They wander and take us out of the moment. But what if the moment is exactly where you want to be? How can we stay there? The answer is mindfulness. This has become a very popular word over the course of the last decade, but how exactly does it work, and how does one actually practice mindfulness? Well, it isn't really a goal to be achieved, but something that needs to be practiced, requiring constant work and focus. In this book, you'll learn the fundamentals of, as well as some of the more advanced techniques for practicing mindfulness. Mindfulness has become a bit of a buzzword in recent times, but what exactly is it? You have perhaps heard that mindfulness is an ancient Buddhist practice. In fact, mindfulness is for everyone, and you need not forswear your earthly possessions and become a Buddhist to enjoy its rewards. Mindfulness is about overriding our automatic approach to life. From a Buddhist perspective, our ordinary state of consciousness is quite limited. We often do things unconsciously, without being fully present in the moment. The simple fact that we are always doing something, while thoughts race through our heads without cease, leaves very little room for us to just be us. So, to truly embrace the present, we need to systematically observe who we are and examine our view of the world. This essentially is mindfulness. So, why be mindful? Well, mindfulness is a tool that helps us realize the richness and possibility of our growth and transformation. Cultivating it reunites us with aspects of ourselves that we often overlook, opening us to new ways of existing both in our own skin and in the world. For example, it can lead us to richer experiences of joy, peacefulness, and happiness, and also to better understandings of difficult emotions like grief, sadness, and fear. That is, those emotions of which we are often unaware or only express unconsciously. Because mindfulness is so illuminating in this way, it is also empowering. As we become more mindful, we become more aware of who we are, which unleashes our creativity and intelligence and gives us clarity. The cultivation of mindfulness and meditation are often confused with things like relaxation, stress relief, or self-development. However, mindfulness is not about aiming for a particular feeling, nor is it about getting somewhere or becoming a particular kind of person. Rather, it is about emptying the mind, becoming still, and allowing ourselves to realize who and where we already are. Developing mindfulness is as easy as incorporating some practices into your daily routine. Let us take a look at some of those. First, rather than doing all the time, begin shifting yourself into being. Here's how. Either sit or lie down, and, once in that position, think of yourself as timeless. Observe the present moment without trying to change anything. Engage your senses and focus on what you see, hear, feel, or on whatever is happening. Try to completely embrace and accept this moment. If you catch your mind straying during the exercise, gently coax your attention back to your breath. Focus on the sensation of your breath moving in and out of your body without getting your mind too involved or trying to change anything. This exercise will enrich the moments of your normal active mode, influencing the decisions you make and providing guidance. Along with accepting the moment, concentration and voluntary simplicity are other practices that will be valuable allies on your path to mindfulness. Concentration is the cornerstone of mindfulness. When you are fully concentrated, your energy is directed toward deeply experiencing one thing or one moment. Everything else falls away, including other thoughts, feelings, and the outer world. People often deeply appreciate this feeling as it allows them to experience inner stillness and an undisturbed peace. You can also try voluntary simplicity, that is, engaging in one activity or with one thought at a time. If you are playing with your daughter, for instance, and you get a text, you could deliberately ignore your phone, instead bringing your full attention to enjoying the game with your child. It is important to not confuse non-doing with doing nothing. Consciously stopping with the intention of cultivating stillness and appreciation is non-doing, but it is not doing nothing. You know those times where you are waiting for a friend who's running late and your annoyance starts to turn into anger? Have you ever paused and thought about how pointless that feeling is? Moving beyond feelings like this is a cornerstone of mindfulness. Choosing to be patient would indeed be far better for your own sanity. Patience and mindfulness are deeply connected. Patience means that you accept things as they are, and you realize events always unfold in their own good time. That may be well and good, but how do you manage your impatience and the anger that accompanies it? To build patience, compassion, and wisdom, start by redirecting and working with anger and impatience. Remarkably, the Dalai Lama seems not to be angry with the Chinese, whose government committed acts of genocide against his people. He understands that even though they have taken everything from his people, he will not allow the Chinese to take his mind too. Instead of putting his energy toward feelings of anger, he uses it to promote understanding and patience. The next time you start getting impatient or angry, remember that wisdom is found in patience, and that what comes next greatly depends on what you do in this moment. Another quality that sets a strong foundation for mindfulness is generosity. This needn't be manifested in the giving of material goods. You can also be generous with your enthusiasm and trust, with your presence and compassion. As you begin to share and give, you will discover the abundance of strength and energy you have at your disposal. When you give, don't get caught up worrying about giving too much, or fretting about your generosity going unappreciated, or thinking that you won't get anything out of it yourself. Practice this by granting yourself the gifts of self-acceptance and a little time every day. Mindfulness can be practiced both formally and informally. Let's take a look at some formal methods first. Formal meditation entails reserving specific periods of time for the development of mindfulness and concentration. All other activities are put on hold. When sitting down to meditate, your posture is extremely important. There is no one correct or incorrect sitting position, but you should sit in a way that displays poise. For most people, this means sitting up straight, without being too stiff, and with your shoulders and face relaxed. Your head, neck, and back should be aligned. You should also position your hands and feet appropriately to direct the flow of your energy. Try paying attention to your varying energy levels and the hand positions that accompany those levels. There is no universal definition of any particular position. It is more about what the positions represent to you. For example, sitting with your palms on your knees may mean that you are simply accepting what is, whereas having your palms facing up might mean being open to a higher energy. The length of time you commit to formal meditation is up to you. Just be sure to come out of your meditation mindfully. As a general guideline, the author found 45 minutes per day to be a good standard practice. That was enough time to achieve stillness, sustain attention, and also experience deep relaxation. During your meditation, you will have an impulse to end it at some point. When this arises, recognize first where it is coming from. Is it fatigue, impatience, discomfort, or is it just time to stop? When you realize where it comes from, stay with the feeling for a bit, breathe with it, and then slowly come out of meditation. Remember, there is no right or wrong meditation practice, so use the above steps as a guideline. The most effective approach is to focus on what feels right to you. Formal meditation is often what comes to mind when we think of meditation, but it is not the only way to meditate. If you find the idea of sitting still for an extended period of time too challenging, or if you want to complement your formal meditation practice, you can also try walking or standing meditation instead. The purpose of a walking meditation isn't to try to get anywhere, so you might choose to walk in a circle or back and forth. The key is to bring your attention to every movement your body makes, each footstep, and how you raise, move, and place your foot. If you do a standing meditation, try doing it around trees, as trees are great teachers for stillness and calmness. You may also want to close your eyes, stand still, and imagine your feet are roots in the ground. Sway your body as trees sway in the breeze. Listen to your surroundings and feel the presence of nature. In addition to walking or standing meditations, lying down meditations are also good practices in mindfulness. As you lie on the floor, consciously release your muscles. This will help your mind to open and release any pressing thoughts. Next, imagine that you are sinking into the floor and bring your focus to your body. You might choose to focus on your body as a whole, as if each skin cell were breathing and radiating energy as one, or on each part of your body separately. The latter is known as a body scan. During your scan, focus on different parts of your body and then release them. Move systematically through your entire body in any direction you like, from head to toe or from side to side. Use your breathing, steering it inward into each part of your body as if you were breathing into your toes or knees, for example, when you exhale. As you exhale, release the muscles, allowing that part to rest in stillness. Being mindful is not something you accomplish and then check off and you are set for the rest of life. It requires constant self-inquiry. But asking yourself questions isn't only about problem solving. It is also about staying connected with life itself, with yourself and with your presence. It means carrying questions with you, contemplating them, being constantly aware of them. Even though mulling questions over in your mind will result in many answer-like thoughts, the main goal is to listen to the thoughts that your questions evoke. Whether your question is, "What is upsetting me right now?" or "What is my purpose in life?" it will help to imagine yourself as an audience, watching and listening to your own thoughts and feelings. Thankfully, no special settings or occasions are needed to practice mindfulness. You can do it anytime. That said, many people find the early morning time to be ideal, the peacefulness and solitude that is often more easily available at this time gives you the space to contemplate and focus on being. An added bonus is that you'll start your day in a peaceful, mindful manner, and therefore be more likely to carry this peace with you throughout the day. But of course, carving out time before you start your day is not necessary. You can even practice mindfulness in the middle of an everyday activity like climbing the stairs. Usually, we do this in a hurry, without a single thought about it. But if you focus on all the intricate movements your body makes as you go up the stairs, you'll increase your awareness of the present, and when you get to the top, you'll be calmer and more connected to the next activity you engage in. The key is to slow down, taking one step at a time, with the goal of increasing presence and awareness. There is no place you need to be and no moment that you need to sacrifice for the sake of being fully present in this one. By now, you have a good picture of what practicing mindfulness involves. Let's now look at some of the most common stumbling blocks and how to get past them. It probably comes as no surprise that as mindfulness is all about the mind, your thoughts and ego are the biggest obstacles you'll face. For example, when you experience a significant moment during meditation, you might start congratulating yourself on doing so well. But be wary of such feelings, as they may be your ego wanting to take credit for being special or giving you a false sense of having made it to the higher level. If this happens, and you feel like the I or me is taking over, try asking yourself where exactly you are supposed to get to. Or, if you're using meditation as a tool to get to a particular place, remember that meditation is not about arriving at a particular destination. It is about understanding and appreciating the present moment to the fullest. Another hurdle you may encounter is the self, or selfing. Selfing is the tendency to keep the mind and the attention on the self, therefore making every moment my moment, and every experience my experience. This can branch out into all aspects of our lives, such as my child, my opinion, my knowledge, and so on. However, when we realize that everything is interdependent, we discover that there is no isolated, independent me or my. The only me that exists is me in relation to all other forces and events in the world. For example, me in terms of my relationship to a child of whom I happen to be the parent. That being said, mindfulness is not about ridding ourselves of our selfing tendency. It is about balancing it, mitigating its impact, seeing things as they are, understanding that everything is connected and constantly changing, and, eventually, learning to take things less personally. Final summary. By being constantly on the move and cramming a crazy amount of activities into our daily schedules, we are losing our ability to fully enjoy the present moment. Our minds are constantly focused on the past or the future, and we are forgetting that the only time we really have is now. Fully appreciating the present is a matter of pausing and bringing it to our attention. This concludes Wherever You Go, There You Are by Jon Kabat-Zinn. Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen. Buddha's Brain is a practical guide to attaining more happiness, love, and wisdom in your life. It aims to empower readers by providing them with practical skills and tools to help unlock their brain's potential and achieve greater peace of mind. Specific attention is paid to the contemplative technique mindfulness, and the latest neurological findings that support it. After reading this book, you will be happier. You'll gain better control over your thoughts, desires, and emotions, which will allow you to become a more positive person. You will stop exacerbating misfortunes. While it is inevitable you will encounter some pain and suffering in this life, you'll no longer make it worse by dwelling on it. You will become a more compassionate and a loving individual. You'll develop more empathy toward others and consequently form deeper, more trusting relationships with them. At any given time, what we feel is the result of the brain and mind interacting with each other. But what exactly distinguishes the brain from the mind? Our minds are our mental processes, our thoughts, wishes, and feelings. In contrast, the brain is a highly complex bundle of connections. So, while the mind is intangible, the brain is physical. For instance, the brain contains chemicals called neurotransmitters that cause us to feel certain emotions, such as happiness. However, our conscious experience is the result of a close interaction between brain and mind. In other words, they form an integrated system. For example, the neurotransmitter dopamine can make us feel excited and energized, sometimes uncomfortably so. Let us say you get a promotion at work, and that your brain responds by releasing lots of dopamine. Whether this will cause you to feel happy or anxious depends on your mind, whose job it is to interpret this flood of dopamine. But the mind's power does not end there. It can also alter the brain's physical structure. Whenever you experience or feel something, this causes neurons to interact or fire with each other. Over time, these neurons physically change as enduring physical connections are created between them. This is known as Hebb's rule, which is neatly expressed in this phrase: neurons that fire together wire together. An example of this process is the simple act of laughing with friends. Doing this will establish new links in the brain between the neurons responsible for your memory of that moment and those triggering feelings of joy, proof that our mental processes can alter the structure of our brains. Here is another example. London cab drivers need to memorize complex street maps and routes. Because of this, they develop a larger-than-average hippocampus, the key area of the brain activated when memorizing and then recalling how to reach a certain location. In other words, their experiences literally alter their brains. Here's a fact. The brain is 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue containing 1.1 trillion cells, including 100 billion neurons. Many of us often feel like victims of our own circumstances, and that our unhappiness and dissatisfaction with life is a foregone conclusion. What we do not realize is that if we actively reflected on these mental processes, this self-reflection would lead to a happier, more prosperous life. Self-reflection is the active endeavor of trying to understand our mental processes to gain better control over them, processes such as the emotions, thoughts, and wishes we experience in our day-to-day life. A good example of self-reflection is thinking about what makes us happy. As you'll recall, mental processes can change our brain's structure, so positive self-reflection will result in positive structural changes to the brain. For instance, more than 2,000 years ago, a young man named Siddhartha, later called Buddha, reflected deeply on the sources of both his happiness and suffering. By doing this, he was able to embrace happiness and free himself from suffering, a psychological transformation which he believed was accomplished by focusing on the positive aspects of his life. Since the brain develops and adapts to whatever it focuses on, if we focus on the positive, we teach the brain to take in good experiences and incorporate them into our lives. Of course, some people are convinced that being self-reflective means being self-indulgent. But this is not the case. By actively reflecting on our lives, we enable ourselves to become better people for both our own sake and those around us. If you pursue a path of self-improvement, you'll see wholesome changes to your personality and life, which will make you a more friendly and good-humored person. For instance, if you develop a more positive outlook on life, your stress levels will diminish, which, in turn, will improve your interpersonal relationships. Just imagine, for example, how much your relationship with your significant other would improve if you were not always fretting about your future. So, exactly how do we do that? As you may already know, our suffering derives from a useful evolutionary trait. It tells us when something is dangerous. In our modern world, however, sometimes these dangers are not so clear. Suffering describes all the feelings in life we do not like and would rather not experience. It is a blanket term for everything from the frustration that comes from just missing your bus to the profound anguish of losing a loved one. Let us look at the role of suffering in more detail. In essence, suffering is Mother Nature's way of keeping us alive. These negative feelings are informative. They tell us what we should avoid. Positive feelings, in contrast, suggest the things we should seek out. These negative or positive feelings arise from very old parts of our brain, which we share with our evolutionary ancestors. Those ancestors had to decide whether to approach something or avoid it. For example, those who survived to pass on their genes to the next generation avoided snakes and approached banana trees for sustenance instead. Additionally, our brains are biased towards avoiding harmful things. Negative memories are preferentially stored over positive memories, so that we do not ever approach that snake, because you only need to make that mistake once. Such approach avoidance behaviors continue to play a major role in our lives today, but with one added burden. We now have to decide whether to approach or avoid abstract mental concepts or states. We avoid not only snakes, but also embarrassment or shame, which have no real danger. And we approach not only bananas, but now also self-worth. But while these approach avoidance behaviors aid our survival, they can also make us unhappy. Approach behaviors, for instance, are not completely positive. They too can involve suffering. Consider the many occasions when we cannot attain the things we approach, desire, or pursue, or when our desires cause us long-term suffering. For example, eating a large dessert after a big meal might feel like just the right thing to do at the time, but can certainly lead to ultimate suffering. Unfortunately, pain is impossible to avoid entirely. However, even though physical and mental discomfort is unavoidable, our suffering arises mostly from our reactions to these discomforts. We usually experience discomfort on two separate levels. The first level can be likened to being struck by a dart. For example, accidentally touching a very hot plate or being rejected by a romantic interest. However, most of our suffering comes from a second dart that we throw at ourselves. This is the second level of pain. Second darts refer to our own reactions and reflections on painful events, be it physical or mental. For instance, stubbing one's toe on a table leg would be a quite painful first dart. The second dart would be the feelings of rage and the impulse to blame someone else. Who moved that chair? This vengeful emotional state is the true suffering we feel, and it is caused by our reaction to the first dart. However, some suffering doesn't even need a first dart as a trigger. This is because suffering always involves strong physical reactions that can trigger further second dart discomforts. How? Suffering kicks the sympathetic nervous system, or SNS, into overdrive. This triggers a flood of adrenaline and an increase in heart rate. That is why the first dart of being rejected by your crush can feel as uncomfortable as a root canal. Then comes the second dart reaction, increasing SNS activity, which causes more second dart reactions in turn, such as being upset about feeling depressed. This snowballs. The body is constantly in a state of emotional stimulation, which is physically and mentally exhausting. For example, if you are anxious about a speech you need to give tomorrow, that feeling of anxiety can remain for hours or even days after you have delivered your speech, and the source of the first dart no longer exists. Did you know that each of us has the means to promote his own well-being, cause positive neurological effects, and help reduce unhealthy desires? All we need to do is learn a few new ways of thinking. The first one is mindfulness. Mindfulness is the state of complete awareness, and it can be generated through meditation. Meditation is key because it helps us to control our attention, which is why we are so aware of our bodies when doing yoga. Moreover, meditation actually increases gray matter in the brain regions that control attention. So, how does mindfulness promote well-being? It does this by stimulating the parasympathetic nervous system, or PNS. We stimulate our PNS when we are mindful. The PNS is like a cousin to the SNS in that it reduces the heart rate and makes us feel calm and restful. In this way, being mindful helps us to feel happy and more relaxed. The second approach is to think about wholesome intentions, as these result in positive neurological effects in all regions of the brain. Intentions are a kind of desire, and an example of a wholesome intention would be thinking about yourself as strong and powerful. Indeed, by actively thinking, "I am strong," it is good to be strong. You can trigger many brain regions from the limbic system to the prefrontal cortex to release neurotransmitters that make you feel good. Lastly, practicing composure helps us to control our emotions and reduces any unhealthy desires we may have. Composure is a state of control that acts much like a circuit breaker. When we are composed, we are able to sever the link between feeling good because of something in particular and having an endless craving for that thing. Practicing composure entails understanding how things make you feel and realizing that your emotional feelings can be separated from your desires. A good example is success. Success makes us feel good, but an endless craving for it can cause us to feel dissatisfied and even depressed. Composure enables us to recognize that we'll be happier if we don't long constantly at all times for it. So far, we have seen that meditation involves focused concentration, but that very concentration is not only a means for gaining awareness, it is also the driving force behind the generation of important insights. Such insights about ourselves and the world around us are fundamental to gaining wisdom, which is defined as the quality of having enduring good judgment. While meditating, our attention is intensely focused. This cuts through all the noise of our everyday lives and illuminates that which is important to us. In turn, this leads to insight. For much of our lives, we exist in a kind of forest of ignorance. By meditating, we develop a sharp knife that can help to clear the path to understanding. The insight we generate sharpens that knife, and the focus we practice gives it power. When it works, meditation can bring about a singleness of mind. In this state, our senses are unified, all distractions are forgotten, and we can experience a deep immersion in the object of our attention. In fact, studies on the brains of experienced meditators discovered a link between singleness of mind and high-frequency gamma waves. These waves are believed to underscore the sense of awareness and mental acuity experienced after meditating. This finding indicates that meditation can help us to become more wise. In order to gain the benefits that singleness of mind can provide, you could try a focused meditation technique such as yoga. Our sense of self is the I with which we experience the world, and it is what we believe makes us who we are. Unfortunately, it also leads to some of our greatest feelings of suffering. We suffer, for example, whenever we take things personally or crave approval or affirmation from others. But when we let go of this strong sense of self and immerse ourselves in the world without ego, we feel a sense of peace and fulfillment. For example, when we do not internalize approval or rely on approval for our own benefit, we lead happier lives. In fact, both Buddhist monks and death row inmates achieve peace by relinquishing the I, adopting instead the mantra, "No self, no problem." However, a strong sense of self often can come in handy. And through meditation, we can learn when to take things personally and when to step back from ourselves. Also, a sense of self helps us to maintain continuity in our experiences from one day to the next, and to relinquish ourselves from other people. But sometimes our sense of self grows beyond our control, which leads to suffering. This happens, for example, whenever we identify with things such as, "This is my laptop," or "I am this given belief." But because everything in the world ultimately comes to an end, our over-identification with things means that eventually we experience loss and subsequently suffering. In other words, by identifying with things, we make their fate our own. Therefore, it is best not to rely on our sense of self unless we really have to. Luckily, meditation can help us to choose when we should and should not exercise our sense of self. For instance, in meditation, we can reflect on things without using personal pronouns. So instead of, "I am thinking of the birds," you could think, "Thoughts of birds are arising." Now that you've learned how to defeat suffering in favor of happiness and wisdom, how do we foster love instead of hate? Have you ever wondered why we love? The short answer is that our capacity to love, a concept that encompasses a wide range of feelings associated with kinship and cooperation, is in our DNA. Indeed, the structure of the human brain has, during our evolution, developed for love. As mammals, we have much larger brains than other species, such as reptiles. In large part, this is due to the need of mammals to manage their offspring in social relationships. For instance, primates' brain size is related to the sociability of the species. The more social the species, the larger the brain. Furthermore, the size of the human brain has tripled in the past 3 million years, and much of that growth is devoted to facilitating good interpersonal relationships. More specifically, the brain has developed certain neural networks that express feelings of love, such as altruism and forgiveness. Moreover, the brain has powerful neurochemistry that facilitates bonding among humans, including oxytocin, which promotes caring. All of this suggests that our large capacity for love has been and continues to be a fundamental part of human survival. For instance, you can find romantic love in all human cultures, which suggests that love is a deep-seated trait in our biological makeup. This biological basis of love is evident in the way that feelings of love help generate trust in communities and play a role in the formation of partnerships for sexual reproduction. Therefore, feelings of love are crucial in helping humans reproduce. Moreover, as we evolved and our brains grew larger, our childhoods grew longer. Because our brains were more complex, it took longer for them to fully develop after birth. Due to this, it became important for parents to develop strong bonds with their offspring in order to care for them and ensure their survival. Have you ever wondered how you could become more compassionate to those around you? Or have you ever considered how empathy could help you to develop a stronger bond to your loved ones? Well, empathy and compassion are closely related. Indeed, empathy is the foundation of true compassion. To have compassion for others means caring deeply about them. When we are empathetic toward others, we gain insight into their perspective. For example, by truly caring about your friend's inner feelings, you'll be more reassuring to them and more compassionate. On the other hand, when our empathy is lacking, there are often harmful consequences. For instance, children who grow up around caregivers who show insufficient empathy are often insecure as adults and struggle to form strong relationships. And when a child grows up with absent parents, he can struggle to relate to people. Unfortunately, this can perpetuate a cycle in which, as an adult, he harbors deep prejudices and becomes an exploitative person. He may in turn become an absent parent to his own children. Yet, there is more empathy than compassion. Being empathetic can open you up to deeper, more successful relationships with others. This is because empathy can help to soothe and diffuse interpersonal conflicts, as, for example, when a good friend criticizes you. If you show that friend empathy, you'll attempt to address and understand her concerns. As a result, she will probably appreciate your empathetic approach and thus be less critical and more understanding of you in the future. Additionally, empathy helps to eradicate any caution we may feel when it comes to being close to others. It is a fact that most psychological pain occurs in close relationships and during our childhood years, because it is in these situations that our memory network and emotional reactions are least controlled by the prefrontal cortex, the decision-making part of the brain. For example, we are more likely to get hurt as a result of putting our trust in a deceitful person when we are young. In contrast, as adults, we simply wouldn't trust that person in the first place. However, by being empathetic as adults, we gradually erode this caution and distrust, and consequently enable ourselves to establish deep connections with other human beings again. Final summary. This book aims to show the reader that anyone can change their life for the better by changing their mental habits. The structure of our brains does not remain the same throughout our lives, but actually develops in tandem with our minds. By understanding and using meditative practices, we can help to transform our brains and, in doing so, achieve happiness.